وقف الطفل وحده والليالي ورصاص من حوله وجنود. وقف الطفل والحجارة أكوام وعيناه عزمة وصمود. وعيناه عزمة وصمود.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, non-commercial community radio station. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the next hour. That music you just heard was Palestine Will Never Die by rapper Low Key, featuring Mai Khalil. 'Tis the season for giving, and before we get rolling, I want to remind you that KBOO is only on the air because of support from listeners like you. Please, if you can, go to kboo.fm/give and click on the donate button, or you can text KBOO to 44321, or click the donate button on your KBOO app. All of us at KBOO thank you for your generous support, which has kept community radio alive in Portland for 55 years. 75 years ago this month, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, which they defined as a crime committed with the intent to destroy a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or in part. Today, genocide has become one of those words that you cannot speak out loud in this country when referring to Israel's wholesale assault on Gaza without risking public censure or worse. This morning, we hear from Mohammed Nabil, a Palestinian rights activist from Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza, now living here in the U.S. In conversation with Jan Hocken, he speaks of the anguish of those who have loved ones in Gaza, the difficulties of knowing what is happening on the ground, the sometimes desperate and always resourceful efforts of Gazans to survive, and the inadequate and hypocritical response from the international community despite repeated declarations endorsed by the United Nations of the Palestinian right to thrive in peace and freedom. Following that, bookmole Larry Bolden will tell us about a lovely little novel called The Collected Regrets of Clover by Mickey Brammer. It's a bittersweet story of a death doula who ushers people through their final days and hours. The regrets are not hers, but rather those of the dying. At the close of our show, Jan Hocken will return with a discussion with Osage member Cynthia Coleman about Killers of the Flower Moon. They take up the character of the Osage woman, Molly Burkhart, at the center of the story. Now, here's Jan Hocken with Palestinian Mohammed Nabil.
Welcome to KBOO, Mohammed Nabil.
It's good to be here.
Well, Mohammed holds a BA in school counseling and psychology and Middle Eastern studies, along with a master's degree in critical theory and creative research. You're now based in Portland, and you've been involved for many years as a Palestinian rights activist, formerly with Super. You can tell us a little about that group in a moment at Portland State University and at Evergreen State College. So thanks so much for coming on to the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning and to talk about your own assessment of what's happening now with the Israelis' assault, ongoing assaults on Gaza, and what you bring from your own life experience from Gaza. Can you start by saying a little bit about yourself and what is happening with your own family now living in Gaza?
Oh yeah, thanks very much, Janice. I appreciate you and I appreciate to be here. Yeah, I'm from Gaza, from Palestine, from Gaza, specifically in Khan Yunis. Khan Yunis is in the south of Gaza Strip. Yeah, I arrived to the US about like 10 years ago. Now I live in Portland, and throughout like the last month and a half, or like we're getting into 2 months right now, I've been watching all of the atrocities that are happening in Gaza. I've been super worried about my family, super worried about my niece and nephews. Yeah, it's been very, very hard to communicate because of the lack of the internet, the lack of actual communication during the periods of blackout. And yeah, trying to do all of that and at the same time trying to lead a life here is immobilizing at its best, but it's never compared, and it's and not compared to what's the life is happening right now in Gaza. People and my family specifically are up to like the beginning of the temporary pause that been enacted in Gaza between Hamas and the Israeli government. It's been hell on earth there. It's imagine like 45 days of constant bombardment, constant fear for your life, constant worry, constant seeking for water, food, fuel, and everything really. And at the same time, trying to know like how many of your relatives and neighbors are still alive. So it's very, very hard to describe what's going on there unless you are there, but we can only predict and try to understand from the footage and from what I hear from my family and from the news, really. And that's like the hardest part because Gaza is a blockaded strip, a blockaded area. You can't get in and you can't get out. So if even people want to go to Gaza and deliver support, food and water and medical supplies, they're not able to because Israel mentioned that like you can't deliver anything without their complete approval. Otherwise, they're gonna shoot it down. So that's the reality.
What do you know about and hear from your family and their community living there? Often the reports tally estimates of deaths and casualties. These are important measures, but they don't capture kind of the desperate struggle for daily survival and the chronic forms of suffering that continue, including being, as you say, terrorized by bombings, and even during this period of a pause, knowing that it's a pause and that that itself can generate tremendous anxiety and suffering, even if you survive it and manage to live.
They call it a humanitarian pause. I wonder what we can call the resumption of the killing. So that's what it is. The reality is, by having this pause and putting us all in limbo and putting the Gaza people in limbo, they are stealing our future from us and stealing our presence because, like, you're always thinking of the temporary, you're always thinking of like the fear, you're always having your entire what do you call it, evacuation bag that in Gaza they have. Every family has like a little bag that's like in case they have to leave or their home, they got a notice that their home gonna be destroyed. They have this bag that has like the basic minimum of like paper document to allow you just like to identify yourself.
And I assume parents talk with their children about these plans as well.
Oh, yes. Here's the thing that's been happening in Gaza. In regards of the children, the parents have this hard conversation with them all the time. What should you do in case one of us have been killed? And that's a very, very hard conversation if you're a parent to have with your child, especially if they are really young and they have their future ahead of them. It's very emotional to talk about it because that's been happening in Gaza since 2000, whatever, all the way up to this war. In this war, what's happening? Because, like, the mass number of killing, we're talking about, 15,000 people have been killed and murdered by the Israeli army, and 7,000 of them are children. So what developed this in terms of, like, how the parents are communicating with their children is the parents are inscribing the children names on their legs and their bodies. So in case they have a bomb or their house have been destroyed with them in it and nobody else survive in the family, the medical teams and the community members can identify who is the parents of this child and, like, how to identify them and to be able to take care of them in the future. So that's heart-wrenching, really, because no kid should have to go through this. No parents should have to go through this. And really, to see this imagery and this story coming out of Gaza and being in the US, knowing that our tax money is paying for this, is really unbearable, really, because, like, there are so many ways that we can support the goodness of humanity without having to spend money on war and support Israeli crimes. That's one of the main things that, like, make the US a big part of this, because it's been over the long since October 7 up to now, and even way before, the US has been the Israeli biggest supporter. And in a way, it's not in a way, it's officially, it's like a complicit with all of the war crimes that Israel is committing.
This is Patricia Kahlberg of the Old Mole Variety Hour, briefly interrupting our show to ask you a question. Did you know that one of the oldest surviving community radio stations in the U.S. is right here in Portland? KBOO has thrived over the years because of support from listeners like you. Please, if you can, go to kboo.fm/give and click on the donate button. Or you can text KBOO to 44321 or click the donate button on your KBOO app. Now, back to the programming that you will not hear on commercial radio.
We are talking today on November 29th, which is the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People, that was created through the United Nations in commemorating or recognizing the Nakba. And the United Nations General Assembly President Dennis Frantz said today that the Palestinian people, as all human beings, are entitled to their fundamental and inalienable right to live in dignity with all liberties, freedom of movement, freedom from fear, and from all any want, and with unfettered access to basic services. And so he calls today for solidarity with the Palestinian people in this Israeli war in Gaza. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that announcement today and whether you think it's meaningful. What does solidarity with Palestinians mean in the context of this war? And how should that be expressed other than in, rhetorical statements?
Yeah, I think the UN is take on Palestine right now is, like, kind of, it's more like immobilized because of how it's structured. Because so all of we have, like, all of the human resolutions, like the Palestinian resolutions from the UN that come that guarantee the Palestinian their homeland, guarantee the Palestinians
And it
the
looks
right
very
of
good when you
return.
read these documents.
Oh yeah. No, if like if you do all the UN resolutions, the Palestinian people will be happy, because we are nowhere near anything. Like, for example, the UN considered the West Bank as a state of apartheid, with all of the settlements that are happening in Jordan Valley and, like, creating an archipelago, if you want to say, of Palestinian territories surrounded by the Israeli settlements. And in order to go from Jerusalem to Hebron, for example, you need to go to through a checkpoint. And that's the same case if you want to go between any two cities in the West Bank. The UN consider that's illegal. And yeah, I consider that illegal. I don't think it should be. The same thing for the Gaza Strip. The UN consider the siege of Gaza since 2005 as an illegal and consider that a form of
Yeah.
occupation because like the Israeli government has been controlling every single aspect of life inside the Gaza Strip,
Right.
including movement, including food, including airspace, including anything. In order to have any meaningful life in Gaza, you have to have the Israeli stamp of approval. And that's considered occupation by the UN.
Yeah. So with the United Nations General Assembly making these statements over a period of time, and it's not just left-wing or radical groups that are making these assessments of the situation, and yet the making these same statements, if you are a student activist now, Palestinian rights activist, there's tremendous censorship and repercussions to even making statements that are in the UN's own pronouncements. So what is your sense now of this movement that's in some ways the largest anti-war movement in over 20 years, and where Palestinian rights are so central now to the struggles many, particularly people of color, identify with around the world? And so it's in a way a very hopeful time, but also so horrific and depressing that it's hard to feel any kind of light on the horizon.
I mean, the feeling is true. And like, it's very hard for me as a Palestinian, as much as I'm happy to see all of this support and all of, we have not seen as much support for the Palestinian people as much as we are seeing right now. And I think that is great. But at the same time, I can't look away from the life that's been destroyed in Gaza. I mean, the Gaza City in the north and Jabalia and the Beit Hanun, all the areas in the north has been completely destroyed. The amount of people have been killed and murdered are like unbelievable and unprecedented.
Also the West
That's
Bank, yeah, and what's happening.
yeah. And the West Bank has been basically more than 160, in the last statement, more than 160 people in the West Bank have been killed. And that's been basically more number than the combination of how many people have been killed over the last 5 years. My main question here and thing is like how many Palestinian people we need to have in order to have more support. Why don't we basically make the support more permanent and more sustainable in terms of like not having to have more atrocities in order to have the support to come. That's like, it's been a very question for me as a Palestinian, questioning both realities. Because, yeah, I am happy to see the support, but at the same time, I'm very upset and very sad about like the numbers and the loss that we are experiencing as Palestinian people. But I still have the hope because with this war, with this assault on Gaza right now, what are people seeing is something crazy, for a lack of a better word, because they are able to see this happening over 45, 50 days now, and they're able to talk about it. They're able to have conversations. They're able to have discourse, and they're able to come down and join the streets and march for Palestine, contacting their senators and representatives and on the state level and the federal level. So from that sense, I am hopeful because I don't think that that is going to go away anytime soon. And I hope that this will be like a start for a true Palestinian liberation.
Can you say a bit more there about both what you think the important demands are right now. We're here in the US. The pressure that we can exert on our own political representatives that are far to the right of the general public in this country on many issues, and including on this one. Apparently, most people in this country, according to surveys, support a ceasefire, but that's still heresy for many politicians. So there's pressure on our own government, but there's also what we would want to support over time in whatever way this war is called to some kind of conclusion.
Well, there's so many ways. So, for example, to start with, the most important demand right now is an immediate ceasefire now. And that is an ask not just like for the political far right or far left. That is an ask from every single political representative in the government, in the Congress, and for Joe Biden himself, because we have only 47 Congress members, two from the Senate, and we have Jeff Merkley here, is one of them, and we have 45 representatives. So
That are calling for a
that
ceasefire.
that's calling for ceasefire. So we need to make this number bigger, and we need to keep the pressure going, because in order to have any meaningful way to move forward, we have to have a ceasefire. We have to make sure that this is not just a pause, because we need to return the present and we need to return the future for Gaza in order to at least start to breathe, in order to go for what's after.
I just want to stay with that point for a moment. How do you respond to, the Biden administration and even many Democrats who say, well, a ceasefire allows Hamas to reorganize and rebuild itself militarily?
What's happening here is Hamas has been in conversation with Israel before,
Right,
and is
quite
in
a bit, yeah.
conversation with Israel right now. How are the prisoners are being released from the Israeli prisons, and how are the Hamas hostages have been released right now? It's because there is conversations. Why are you able to have a conversation with them now and not want to have a conversation with them in the future? You've been having these conversations in the past before October 7th, and they've been attacking Israel before October 7th. They are there. Like, you can't just like ignore what's happening just because you are not able to eliminate them.
Yeah, and they've been abiding by the ceasefire. I know in some of the talk shows there was all of this loose talk about how Hamas would never honor a ceasefire, it would only be Israel. Obviously, they're proceeding in a very orderly way and have complied with the
They
agreements.
have been communicating. They have been cooperating. They have the demands are being sent to the US, and the hostages are being released. So if that tells us that there is a conversation and a conversation is possible, why keep killing? We don't know yet if Israel have achieved anything in Gaza according to that complies with their objectives. All what we know in Gaza right now is that 15,000 people have been killed. We have over 40,000 people have been injured. We know that half of the houses in Gaza is destroyed and half of the population is displaced. These are what Israel is doing right now. We don't know, we don't have any evidence that Israel have been achieving any of its objectives, but all of this killing and destruction that's happening. So it's time for this destruction to end and to start to have like a meaningful ceasefire and a meaningful approach to the future for the Palestinian people's safety and for the Israeli people's safety, because nobody want to see any life to be spilled, and nobody want to see this destruction to continue.
Well, Mohammed Nabil, can you say a bit now in closing about what you'd like listeners to be aware of? There's ongoing mobilization on the streets, but also people reaching out to their representatives. And it's so important, as you've said, to keep pressure on our own government, particularly the federal government, but all our representatives, to demand a ceasefire and to support Palestinians in determining their own future without the boot of Israel on their backs.
Exactly. So I encourage all the audience to read about Palestine, to read about the boycott, divestment, and sanction in order to pressure Israel to basically acknowledge the Palestinian people, and until Israel reached the demands of the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, which is the end of the Gaza siege, the right of return for the Palestinian people, end of the occupation of the Palestinians of Palestine and the West Bank, and also have equal rights for the Palestinian people who are living in Israel right now. There's 20% of the Israeli population who are actually Palestinian, who have been there before 1948, before the establishment of the State of Israel, and release of all the Palestinian prisoners in Israel. Like, there is more than 10,000 people are imprisoned who are Palestinians in the Israeli prisons. Most of them are without even a criminal record, or like a charge.
Another part of the story of Palestinian people under occupation and Israeli rule that you are learning more through this hostage prisoner exchange about how many young people are in jails in Israel under dubious charges
or no charges at all.
Formally charged, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me today on The Old Mole, and for your work. And I extend my deepest heartfelt support and concern for your family and community there. I'm sure it must be so difficult, but important for them to know that you're in contact with them and working here. And there are so many others here in support of Palestinian rights to survive and thrive.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, take care.
Image out of my heart when we've seen the bodies found in a mountain of parts. Netanyahu told you just another child of the dark. Clear it's gonna take much more than thousands to march, more than a speech, more than a poem, more than a track of music. Gonna take more than a sit down with Bassem Youssef.
That music was a little more of the song Palestine Will Never Die by rapper Low Key featuring Mai Khalil. Next up, Larry Bolden reviews a novel about dying, which turns out to be as much about living. I will be reading for Larry. Quote, "Shepherding a dying person through the last days of life is a privilege, especially when you're the only thing they have to hang on to." So says Clover, the hero and death doula of Mickey Brammer's quirky and lovely novel, The Collected Regrets of Clover. With 9 million people living in New York, a city of lonely people full of regrets, there is plenty of work for Clover. I'm a bit embarrassed to admit that I had never heard of a death doula until I read this book, nor of death clubs, where people who cannot talk to family or loved ones about death come together to talk openly about death and dying. My reader friends all seem to have heard of death doulas and birth doulas. Quote, "I always let the dying person take the lead to decide if they want to fill their final days with conversation or to revel in silence. They don't need to verbalize their decision. I can just tell. It's my job to stay calm and present, letting them take up space as they navigate those last precious moments of life." End quote. The reader is told that Clover first watched someone die when her kindergarten teacher dropped dead in front of his class. For reasons unknown, Clover remained calm throughout the event. I sat beside him, holding his hand calmly, as the last blush of red disappeared from his face. The second strand of the novel is Clover's own loneliness and limited ability to let others into her life and her hidden need for companionship. She is still grieving the death of her grandfather, who was her best friend and advisor. Her friends think she has been grieving for too long and ought to be over it by now. Quote, I've never understood Western society's warped perception of grief as something quantifiable and finite. 8 months after Grandpa died, my doctor suggested I see a psychiatrist because I was still having trouble accepting he was gone. After only one session, the psychiatrist promptly diagnosed me with persistent complex bereavement disorder, aka chronic grief, and suggested I take antidepressants. Turns out, in the opinion of most medical experts, your grieving process shouldn't last longer than 6 months, and if you aren't over it by then, there's something clinically wrong with you. End quote. Clover has three notebooks on her shelf entitled Regrets, Advice, Confessions. When her friends ask her about her diaries and even asks to read them, Clover won't allow it. Quote, they're not diaries exactly. They're more, well, I kind of keep a record of the last things people say before they die. You know, like their words of wisdom and stuff. And I guess it would feel like an invasion of their privacy if I let somebody else read them. End quote. Her friend replies that they are all dead, so who would know? I would know, Clover says. Just because no one's there to witness it doesn't make it okay. Most of the words in those notebooks have been spoken when people were their most vulnerable. I could never betray their trust. End quote. There are so many insights in this little book, like her grandfather, and like I, as a teacher, believe. Curiosity is even more important than native intelligence. As Clover puts it, infinite curiosity and a keen sense of observation. Clover learns many things from her clients. Claudia, one of the last clients Clover meets when she'd accepted regret as the foregone conclusion of her life. Under Claudia's tutelage, she comes to a new position. Quote, don't let the best parts of life pass you by because you're too scared of the unknown. Be cautiously reckless. End quote. I am an old man now, and this book spoke to me in a brave, soft voice, urging me not to let living become a habit instead of a privilege. The author leaves us with this as the final word, quote, instead of constantly asking ourselves the question of why we're here, maybe we should be savoring a simpler truth. We are here. End quote. I have already bought and distributed 5 copies of this book, and I recommend it to all of you readers. I have been talking about Mickey Brammer's 2023 novel, The Collected Regrets of Clover. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Patricia Kohlberg, reading today for Larry. That music you just heard was the Adagietto from Gustav Mahler's 5th Symphony. Did you know that hundreds of local radio activists have learned how to produce radio right here at KBOO and all for free? KBOO is a vibrant radio community that gives voice to a great diversity of folks in the Portland area. To support our work, you can go to kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or click on the donate button on your KBOO app. The KBOO community thanks you for your support. We turn now to another discussion on the much-discussed movie by Martin Scorsese, Killers of the Flower Moon. Jen Hawkins speaks with Osage tribal member Cynthia Coleman, who talks a bit about the making of the film before she and Jan discuss the character of the Osage woman, Molly Burkhart, at the center of the story. How much does the film conform to standard tropes in depicting Molly as a woman, abused wife, an indigenous person? And how much does the story depart from those common cliches?
Welcome to KBOO, Cynthia Lou Coleman.
Good morning, Jen. How are you?
Good. And it's so delightful to have you on the show again. You're a professor emerita of communications at Portland State University and a researcher in the fields of scientific discourse, environmental policies, and their impacts on North American Indigenous peoples. Last month, you were on the show to talk about your recent book, Environmental Clashes on Native American Lands. So it's great to have you back on the program today to talk about Martin Scorsese's new film, Killers of the Flower Moon. Earlier this fall, Kaylee Simmons, Assistant Professor of Indigenous Nations Studies at Portland State University, joined me to talk about Scorsese's new film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The film is based on the 2017 nonfiction book by David Gran and tells a story of the Osage tribe during an era when the discovery of oil on tribal lands in Oklahoma leads to wealth for Osage members and a series of tragedies, including horrific killings. Well, Cynthia Coleman, you are an enrolled member of the Osage Nation, so I appreciate your willingness to join me on the Omol to talk about the film from that perspective, as well as from your work as a scholar at the intersection of Indigenous and Western or settler colonial ways of knowing. Before talking about the film, would you want to say a bit more to introduce yourself?
Yes, and thank you very much again, Dr. Hacken, for having me on. You know, one of the things that the film has done is brought to light issues in Native America, not just the Reign of Terror. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk, and I would like to say I don't speak for other Osage people, and I don't speak for Native American people. It's only my own experience, so I wanted to make sure that people didn't misinterpret what I have to say. I was not born on the reservation, but my mother was, her mother was, and her mother was. So I feel like I am part of the tribe, even though I wasn't born there. And I've been taking advantage of the online language classes that they've had, courtesy of actually the pandemic. So they've sort of expanded their language classes, and I am happy to introduce myself to you in Osage. It's, I would say to you, Have, Ietoa Kipshe Combre Mikshita Wita, Nirkonska Wajaje, Shaje Wita, Cynthia Lou Coleman, Estatoto Apasoli. So, what I said to you in my very poor Osage or Wajaje is that I'd like to tell you a few words in Osage, and my name is Cynthia Coleman, and my Lakota name is Ishtatoto, and I am from Gray Horse. So that sort of sets the stage. It also sets the stage a little bit for the film, in the sense that the film is actually in the three villages of the Osage Nation, and it's set within a place we call Fairfax, which is cheek to jowl with Gray Horse, which is the name of the, shall I say, township where all this took place in the film. And so I would just say that It's accurate. It was filmed on location. I got the impression reading through the Osage News and listening to the elders that the director was very respectful and that Indigenous people were involved. Osage people were involved at every step of the way in terms of the language, in terms of some of the actors and some of the crew as well. And the woman who helped with the costume design, you know, we don't call them costumes, by the way, but that's what they call them in Hollywood, you know, was really has gotten a lot of good press for making sure the design was correct. So I will say that that is the sort of the public feeling that is available if you get onto the Osage Tribal website, very easy to find. They have glowing reviews of the film. And if you were to challenge that, I think the response is likely something like, well, it's just a movie.
Yeah. So I think the point here is you can overinvest, particularly in a film that's unique in portraying a politically repressed part of American history that is fraught in so many ways and bringing it into consciousness through the medium of a very famous American film director who's also particularly known for gangster films, for his portrayals of rugged anti-heroes, and where the main characters are perhaps marginalized, but still at the center of kind of the American imaginary around, you know, the Western outlaw or gangster. And so this was a shift for him. And maybe we can talk about the gender politics of the film, which have, much like all of Scorsese's films, an air of critique, you know, that the female characters are often marginal to the main arc of the story, or just there to facilitate a passage in the hero, the anti-hero story. So would that be an okay place to begin?
Sure, we can talk about that and refer your audience members to your interview with Dr. Simmons in November, who is a historian of film, but also teaches film and, you know, can lend a different expertise. So it's a really good question to ask, what are the roles that the characters are playing in the film? It's different from the book. This is a film. It has a different arc in terms of telling a story. The word on the street is that Scorsese and the writers, and one of the writers is David Gran as well, but there are other writers involved. We're looking at this story through the lens of the white savior man who works for the FBI as coming in and saving the day. And what Scorsese said publicly, in terms of news reports that I can get my hands on, is that it changed when he came to Oklahoma to meet with the Osage people. He met with them long before the film was ever made, to broker a good relationship with them. And he changed his mind. He said the arc of the story changed. And by that, I mean, it was not focused on Tom White, who is the name of the FBI director, who was sent in, and it sent in to solve these murders. So the backstory for people that haven't seen the film is that the film is about a series of murders that take place on the reservation in the 1920s, because the laws were written in such a way that the Osage people inherited the wealth from the oil that was discovered there. And this was something that is also part of the story that's really not told in the film. And that is that at the end of the day, the Osages were among the last that were relocated. And because David Gran writes that because they were among the last tribes, they had a bit more ability to negotiate with the federal government about the property that they ended up purchasing in Oklahoma. And in the book, Gran says that the chief at the time said, this is a desolate place. And so maybe we won't be bothered anymore by people coming in and wanting our land. But what they also did was they negotiated for the mineral rights. And that is how the Osage people were able to benefit from the discovery of oil. And this is rather new. So, of course, you skip forward to the time where they actually not only discover oil, but they're able to harness it. It's not something that you can...
Oil boom.
Exactly. You can't do anything with it unless you have the ability to extract that resource, right? So this is where a lot of people who are not Native got involved, right? You know, sort of, you know, building the oil wells, building the oil rigs, and they were offered leases by the Osage. So you see that in the film. You see people coming in to bid on the oil lease. And because the Osages would profit from that oil, to get back to sort of to circle back to your original question, is that they inherited what is called a head right to that oil. It remained in your family. But if you married somebody who was white, that's also part of your family. And there were some people that killed Osage men and women for that head right. And so that's really the centerpiece of the story in terms of solving these murders. Your question is, you know, what are the roles that are played? And, you know, one thing is that the attention was turned away from the FBI person. I mean, he was not the central character. The central character is a family, and the family includes a white gentleman and includes an Osage woman. And what is nice about the movie from the perspective of women being more important than just sort of ornaments to follow is that the character of Molly Burkhart is central to the story. And her husband, Ernest, is played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And so you can imagine that there is a lot of thought about who's DiCaprio going to be? He's a central person. Molly is played by Lily Gladstone, who is an actress, but I would say not an accomplished actress, nor in the same vein as DiCaprio. So there's a lot of talk on the street about the fact that she held the film together. Manolo Dargis, who was writing for the New York Times, said that she's the centerpiece of the story.
Yeah, she's the moral compass and offers a riveting performance, so much going on without even her speaking in various points. But she also could be viewed through the lens of a well-known Native character, of the stoical moral presence of the Native who observes the horrors but abides in a spiritual realm above them. And she's for a long time through the film blind to her husband's violence and exploitive maneuvering of her and killing people in her own family. So is there a kind of dual place of woman as outside of man, of the evil doings of men, but kind of rising above them as a in a moral sphere that has been one trope, you know, for right. casting Native people as essentially spiritual and kind of outside the picture in a certain way. In the book, she seemed much more actively angry and reactive to what was happening around her than in the film, in my view.
I think that's also something that I've heard other people say. When we got out of the cinema, you know, one of the things that we were talking about is that relationship. And, you know, we were asking each other, well, do you think Molly knew? And, you know, what was going on? And I obviously can't answer that because that's all your own impression of what's going on. In terms of the stoicism, I do think that that is a trope that we see in a lot of Westerns. I also think there's a slightly different way of looking at it. And if I can give you a couple of examples, which I thought were not stoicism as much as part of an indigenous culture. So this is really, it really hits home for me. And that is that she says to Ernest early when they meet, "You talk too much." And if you read some of the, not just the fiction, but the nonfiction books that are written by not just Osage people, but other Indigenous people as well, it's actually considered rude manners to talk a lot, and
I've learned that painfully.
I'm sure.
as a talker.
And I think we can look at that as a kind of stoicism, but it's also like, you know, there are stories about people being silent, and then somebody saying, "Why don't they say anything?" And it's like, doesn't have anything to say. You know, not every space needs to be filled with conversation.
But this was a very profound tragedy unfolding for her. And I think the film did lead us to believe she was blind to it. And maybe that was an interesting theme in and of itself, that there seemed to be some genuine love between her and her murderous husband.
Yes, I think
white man, and so that it kind of complicated some of that relationship as well, which of course is true in many lives of women who have abusive relationships with men. They can be complicated,
right? And I think we as audience members want to see her, either stick up for herself or sort of say something to Ernest or say something to somebody else about Ernest. And I think looking back at all these events that take place, beginning with Anna's death and then her mother's death, it just feels like it keeps adding on, right? So there's this death, her child's death. And at the same time, she's being diminished because of the poisons that she's been given. Her mother was given poisons as well, according to David Gran. And I wonder if that is also the story, that it just is a pile of poop, and how do you find your way out of it?
The audience isn't offered this kind of resilient woman character who's expected to stand up to her abusive husband, but rather you see her undoing, although then she rises up at the end through the help of others. But yeah, and so there is a kind of expectation often on the part of in domestic violence stories and films that the woman rises up, and it doesn't take into account all of the ways that in the story, as an Osage person, she was under the toxic spell, very literally, of this husband who was killing her and slowly weakened in the process, diminished.
Right. And I think it also shows, at least for me, that Molly was a trusting person. You know, she was not a person who looked at somebody and said, how is this person going to screw me over? But rather, this, taking him at his word. And recall at the end of the film, when they're having conversations, she says, "Is there something else that you're giving me?" And he says, "No," and she trusts him. I think that's important. Important part of her character, not necessarily because she's Native, but because she's a trusting individual.
And I think that does come through at the conclusion of the film, that the trauma and the toxic and lethal world that the Osage people have endured have not destroyed the spirit and capacities of Osage people. So there was an affirmation of that at the end of the film as well, that I think has been, I know Kayla Simmons emphasized that as well. It's a lot of our analyses of films center on the denouement. Where does the film end, and who are the survivors, who's left standing at the end? Well, I so much appreciate your coming onto the show today to talk, Cynthia Coleman, about Killers of the Flower Moon and bringing some of your own thoughts and insights to the film. And I think it's certainly worth seeing. And as you said, people are immediately talking about it as though the film is real. Like, okay, what's really happening? Well, it is a film's impression. Like the Osage Elder said, it's just a movie, but it's a pretty profound one because it takes up a sacred and important and forgotten part of American history, particularly for non-Native people.
Exactly. And I appreciate your comment too about the fact that it's just one moment in time, and that the Osages have not only survived, but we have also persevered. And Jean Dennison, who is a fellow Osage, wrote an editorial, if you have time to look at it, in Time Magazine. It's the 19th of October when this film was released. And it's a very good piece that explains, look, the film is out, we get that, but let me tell you what we've done since that. And she talks about the fact that the Osages passed a resolution in 2006 that made it much easier to have its own governance. They bought up land from Ted Turner to expand our own reservation. We basically bought back our land. But, you know, they've reinvigorated the language programs, the health programs, and are thriving.
Yeah. As many Indigenous people have told me, we're still here.
Yes, right.
Here. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for being here today.
You're so welcome. Thank you for inviting me, Jen.
Jenna Hawken, talking today with Dr. Cynthia Coleman about the film Killers of the Flower Moon. Take care.
That was a clip from the soundtrack of the movie Killers of the Flower Moon. Before that, you heard Jan Hawken in conversation with Osage member Cynthia Coleman about the movie. That does it for our show this morning. Our thanks to Moles, Jan Hawken, and Larry Bolden for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guests this morning, Mohammed Nabil and Cynthia Coleman. A shout out to the KABU staff, without whom none of this would be possible. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I've been your host this morning. Catch us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. Before we go, I want to remind you one last time that KABU is now in our winter fund drive, and we need your support. It takes more than dedication and hard work to keep the station on the air. If you can, please take a moment to donate to KABU, or better yet, become a monthly sustainer. You can do all this by going to kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or click on the donate button on your KABU app. The KABU community thanks you. خلص الحكي شو بعد خلص البكي. I'm going to leave you today with a song called Kels El Haki by Palestinian artist Eliana. Thanks for listening.